Chapter 14. As soon as Miles Hendon and the Little Prince were clear of the mob, they struck down through back lanes and alleys toward the river. Their way was unobstructed until they approached London Bridge. Then they plowed into the multitude again, Hendon keeping a fast grip upon the prince's, no, the king's wrist. The tremendous news was already abroad, and the boy learned it from a thousand voices at once, the king is dead. The tidings struck a chill to the heart of the poor little waif, and sent a shudder through his frame. He realized the greatness of his loss, and was filled with a bitter grief, for the grim tyrant who had been such a terror to others, had always been gentle with him. The tears sprang to his eyes, and blurred all objects. For an instant he felt himself the most forlorn, outcast, and forsaken of God's creatures. Then another cry shook the night with its far-reaching thunders. Long live King Edward VI! And this made his eyes kindle, and thrilled him with pride to his fingers' ends. Ah, he thought, how grand and strange it seems I am king. Our friends threaded their way slowly through the throngs upon the bridge. This structure, which had stood for 600 years, and had been a noisy and populous thoroughfare all that time, was a curious affair, for a closely packed rank of stores and shops, with family quarters overhead, stretched along both sides of it, from one bank of the river to the other. The bridge was a sort of town to itself. It had its inn, its beer houses, its bakeries, its haberdasheries, its food markets, its manufacturing industries, and even its church. It looked upon the two neighbors which it linked together, London and Southwark, as being well enough as suburbs, but not otherwise particularly important. It was a close corporation, so to speak. It was a narrow town, of a single street a fifth of a mile long. Its population was but a village population, and everybody in it knew all his fellow townsmen intimately, and had known their fathers and mothers before them and all their little family affairs into the bargain. It had its aristocracy, of course, its fine old families of butchers, and bakers, and whatnot, who had occupied the same old premises for 500 or 600 years, and knew the great history of the bridge from beginning to end, and all its strange legends, and who always talked bridgey talk, and thought bridgey thoughts, and lied in a long, level, direct, substantial bridgey way. It was just the sort of population to be narrow, and ignorant and self-conceited. Children were born on the bridge, were reared there, grew to old age, and finally died without ever having set a foot upon any part of the world, but London Bridge alone. Such people would naturally imagine that the mighty and interminable procession which moved through its street night and day, with its confused roar of shouts and cries, its neighings and bellowing and bleatings and its muffled thunder tramp, was the one great thing in this world, and themselves somehow the proprietors of it. And so they were, in effect, at least they could exhibit it from their windows, and did, for a consideration, whenever a returning king or hero gave it a fleeting splendor, for there was no place like it for affording a long, straight, uninterrupted view of marching columns. Men born and reared upon the bridge found life unendurably dull and in and elsewhere. History tells of one of these who left the bridge at the age of 71 and retired to the country. But he could only fret and toss in his bed. He could not go to sleep. The deep stillness was so painful, so awful, so oppressive. When he was worn out with it, at last, he fled back to his old home, a lean and haggard specter, and fell peacefully to rest, and pleasant dreams under the lulling music of the lashing waters, and the boom and crash and thunder of London Bridge. In the times of which we are writing, the bridge furnished object lessons in English history for its children, namely, the livid and decaying heads of renowned men impaled upon iron spikes atop of its gateways. But we digress. Hendon's lodgings were in the little inn on the bridge. As he neared the door with his small friend, a rough voice said, "So, thou'rt come at last. Thou'lt not escape again, I warrant thee. and if pounding thy bones to a pudding can teach thee somewhat, thou'lt not keep us waiting another time. Mayhap and John Candy put out his hand to seize the boy. Miles Hendon stepped in the way and said, "Not too fast, friend. Thou art needlessly rough, methinks. What is the lad to thee? If it be any business of thine to make, and meddle in others' affairs, he is my son." "'Tis a lie," cried the little king, hotly. "Boldly said, and I believe thee, whether thy small headpiece be sound or cracked, my boy. But whether this scurvy ruffian be thy father or no, 'tis all one, he shall not have thee to beat thee and abuse, according to his threat, so thou prefer to bide with me. I do, I know him not, I loathe him, and will die, before I will go with him. Then 'tis settled, and there is not more to say. We will see, as to that," exclaimed John Candy, striding past Hendon to get at the boy. "By force shall he, if thou do but touch him, thou animated offal, I will spit thee like a goose," said Hendon, barring the way and laying his hand upon his sword hilt. Candy drew back. "Ow, Marquis," continued Hendon, "I took this lad under my protection, when a mob of such as thou would have mishandled him, mayhap killed him. Dost imagine I will desert him now to a worser fate? For whether thou art his father, or no, and sooth to say, I think it is a lie a decent swift death were better for such a lad than life in such brute hands as thine. So go thy ways, and set quick about it, for I like not much bandying of words, being not over patient in my nature." John Candy moved off, muttering threats and curses, and was swallowed from sight in the crowd. Hendon ascended 3 flights of stairs to his room, with his charge, after ordering a meal to be sent thither. It was a poor apartment, with a shabby bed and some odds, and ends of old furniture in it, and was vaguely lighted by a couple of sickly candles. The little king dragged himself to the bed, and lay down upon it, almost exhausted with hunger and fatigue. He had been on his feet a good part of a day, and a night, for it was now 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and had eaten nothing meantime. He murmured drowsily, "Prithee call me, when the table is spread," and sank into a deep sleep immediately. A smile twinkled in Hendon's eye, and he said to himself, "By the mass, the little beggar takes to one's quarters, and usurps one's bed with as natural and easy a grace, as if he owned them with never a by your leave or so please it you, or anything of the sort." In his diseased ravings he called himself the Prince of Wales, and bravely doth he keep up the character. Poor little friendless rat, doubtless his mind has been disordered with ill usage. Well, I will be his friend. I have saved him, and it draweth me strongly to him. Already I love the bold-tongued little rascal. How soldier-like he faced the smutty rabble, and flung back his high defiance. And what a comely, sweet and gentle face he hath, now that sleep hath conjured away its troubles and its griefs. I will teach him, I will cure his malady, yea, I will be his elder brother, and care for him, and watch over him. And woso would shame him, or do him hurt may order his shroud, for though I be burnt for it, he shall need it. He bent over the boy, and contemplated him with kind and pitying interest, tapping the young cheek tenderly, and smoothing back the tangled curls with his great brown hand. A slight shiver passed over the boy's form. Hendon muttered, "See, now, how like a man it was to let him lie here uncovered, and fill his body with deadly rheums. Now what shall I do? 'Twill wake him to take him up, and put him within the bed, and he sorely needeth sleep." He looked about for extra covering, but finding none, doffed his doublet, and wrapped the lad in it, saying, "I am used to nipping air and scant apparel, 'tis little I shall mind the cold." Then walked up and down the room, to keep his blood in motion, soliloquizing as before. His injured mind persuades him he is Prince of Wales. 'Twill be odd to have a Prince of Wales still with us, now that he that was the prince's prince no more, but king, for this poor mind is set upon the one fantasy, and will not reason out that now it should cast by the prince, and call itself the king. If my father liveth still, after these 7 years, that I have heard not from home in my foreign dungeon, he will welcome the poor lad, and give him generous shelter for my sake. So will my good elder brother, Arthur, my other brother, Hugh, but I will crack his crown and he interfere, the fox-hearted, ill-conditioned animal. Yes, thither will we fare and straightway to. A servant entered with a smoking meal, disposed it upon a small deal table, placed the chairs, and took his departure, leaving such cheap lodgers as these to wait upon themselves. The door slammed after him, and the noise woke the boy, who sprang to a sitting posture, and shot a glad glance about him. Then a grieved look came into his face, and he murmured to himself, with a deep sigh, "Alack, it was but a dream, woe is me." Next he noticed Miles Hendon's doublet glanced from that to Hendon, comprehended the sacrifice that had been made for him, and said, "Gently, thou art good to me, yes, thou art very good to me. Take it and put it on, I shall not need it more." Then he got up and walked to the washstand in the corner and stood there, waiting. Hendon said in a cheery voice, "We'll have a right hearty sup and bite now, for everything is savory and smoking hot, and that and thy nap together will make thee a little man again, never fear." The boy made no answer, but bent a steady look that was filled with grave surprise, and also somewhat touched with impatience, upon the tall knight of the sword. Hendon was puzzled, and said, "What's amiss?" "Good sir, I would wash me." "Oh, is that all? Ask no permission of Miles Hendon for aught thou cravest. Make thyself perfectly free here, and welcome, with all that are his belongings." Still the boy stood, and moved not. More, he tapped the floor once or twice with his small impatient foot. Hendon was wholly perplexed. Said he, "Bless us, what is it? Prithee pour the water, and make not so many words." Hendon, suppressing a hoarse laugh, and saying to himself, "By all the saints, but this is admirable," stepped briskly forward, and did the small insolent spitting, then stood by, in a sort of stupefaction, until the command, "Come the towel," woke him sharply up. He took up a towel, from under the boy's nose, and handed it to him without comment. He now proceeded to comfort his own face with a wash, and while he was at it his adopted child seated himself at the table and prepared to fall to. Hendon dispatched his ablutions with alacrity, then drew back the other chair, and was about to place himself at table, when the boy said, indignantly, "Forbear! Wouldst sit in the presence of the king?" This blow staggered Hendon to his foundations. He muttered to himself, "Lo, the poor thing's madness is up with the time. It hath changed with the great change that is come to the realm, and now in fancy is he king. Good lack, I must humor the conceit, to there is no other way, faith, he would order me to the tower, else." And pleased with this jest, he removed the chair from the table, took his stand behind the king, and proceeded to wait upon him in the courtliest way he was capable of. While the king ate, the rigor of his royal dignity relaxed a little, and with his growing contentment came a desire to talk. He said, "Think thou callest thyself Miles Hendon, if I heard thee aright?" "Yes, sire," Miles replied, then observed to himself, "If I must humor the poor lad's madness, I must sire him, I must majesty him, I must not go by halves, I must stick at nothing that belongeth to the part I play, else shall I play it ill, and work evil to this charitable and kindly cause." The king warmed his heart with a second glass of wine, and said, "Would know thee, tell me thy story. Thou hast a gallant way with thee, and a noble art nobly born? We are of the tale of the nobility, good your majesty. My father is a baronet, one of the smaller lords by knight service, to Sir Richard Hendon of Hendon Hall, by Monk's Holm in Kent. The name has escaped my memory. Go on, tell me thy story. 'Tis not much, your majesty, yet perchance it may beguile a short half hour for want of a better. My father, Sir Richard, is very rich, and of a most generous nature. My mother died, whilst I was yet a boy. I have two brothers. Arthur, my elder, with a soul, like to his father's, and you, younger than I, a mean spirit, covetous, treacherous, vicious, underhanded, a reptile. Such was he from the cradle, such was he 10 years past, when I last saw him a ripe rascal at 19, I being 20 then, and Arthur 22. There is none other of us, but the Lady Edith, my cousin. She was 16 then, beautiful, gentle, good, the daughter of an earl, the last of her race, heiress of a great fortune and a lapsed title. My father was her guardian. I loved her, and she loved me, but she was betrothed to Arthur from the cradle, and Sir Richard would not suffer the contract to be broken. Arthur loved another maid, and bade us be of good cheer and hold fast to the hope that delay and luck together would someday give success to our several causes. Hugh loved the Lady Edith's fortune, though in truth he said it was herself he loved, but then 'twas his way, alway, to say the one thing and mean the other. But he lost his arts upon the girl. He could deceive my father, but none else. My father loved him best of us all, and trusted and believed him, for he was the youngest child, and others hated him, these qualities being in all ages sufficient to win a parent's dearest love. And he had a smooth persuasive tongue, with an admirable gift of lying, and these be qualities which do mightily assist a blind affection to cozen itself. I was wild in troth. I might go yet farther, and say very wild, though 'twas a wildness of an innocent sort, since it hurt none but me, brought shame to none, nor loss, nor had in it any taint of crime or baseness, or what might not beseem mine honorable degree. Yet did my brother Hugh turn these faults to good account, he seeing that our brother Arthur's health was but indifferent, and hoping the worst might work him profit were I swept out of the path so. But we're a long tale, good my liege, and little worth the telling. Briefly then, this brother did deftly magnify my faults, and make them crimes, ending his base work with finding a silken ladder in mine apartments, conveyed thither by his own means, and did convince my father by this, and suborned evidence of servants and other lying knaves, that I was minded to carry off my Edith, and marry with her in rank defiance of his will. 3 years of banishment from home, and England might make a soldier and a man of me, my father said, and teach me some degree of wisdom. I fought out my long probation in the continental wars, tasting sumptuously of hard knocks, privation, and adventure. But in my last battle I was taken captive, and during the 7 years that have waxed and waned since then, a foreign dungeon hath harbored me. Through wit and courage I won to the free air at last, and fled hither straight, and am but just arrived, right poor in purse and raiment, and poorer still in knowledge of what these dull 7 years have wrought at Hendon Hall, its people and belongings. So please you, sir, my meager tale is told. Thou hast been shamefully abused, said the little king, with a flashing eye. But I will right thee by the cross, will I. The king hath said it. Then, fired by the story of Miles' wrongs, he loosed his tongue, and poured the history of his own recent misfortunes into the ears of his astonished listener. When he had finished, Miles said to himself, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.